Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome. This is Genuinely Grace with the Alcohol Free Life podcast. How are you doing? I hope you've had a good week, whatever's going on for you. We've had a great week in the Sober Club. We did our big coaching session, How to Boss Your Sober Christmas. And it was great, you know, to be able to share some of this information. And I did a kind of coaching session with using NLP, which I think can be just amazing, actually, for this kind of thing. But it was really good to hear people talking about kind of recognizing what goes on at this time of year, because there's no doubt about it, it's super emotional. I mean, even on a regular year, let alone 2020, Christmas, and when you start to get towards Christmas, all of these weird emotions can start to pop up for people. It can be a very traumatic time. And even, you know, for those of us who are kind of okay, we find ourselves, I think, in many cases, putting new identities on that don't necessarily serve us. And if you've got kids, you can sort of get into this frenzy of trying to be the perfect parent and deliver the perfect gifts. And you know, if you have a partner, it's this kind of trying to be, I don't know, there's something very weird happens at Christmas time. And I think I've kind of always known it, but now I've ditched the booze. It's another one of those things that kind of you can see in glorious technicolor. You can see how odd it is. And ultimately, it's just one day, right? Or a bunch of days. And for some people, it's a regular day like any other. They're going to work, or maybe they're going to help out with a charity. And, you know, it's just a day. And but by the same token, for some people, it's huge. And of course, it's a tradition. And many of us have this kind of hankering to go back to stuff we did in childhood, or to make little Christmas traditions the same as they've always been. And I think, again, particularly after a year like this, there's a sort of a need for things to feel, normal. I can't use that word anymore. But, you know, to feel as they were, and to feel comforting, and to feel safe. And again, I use the traditional sense of that word. And I think Christmas brings up all of these emotions. I've had several clients who've said, I'm feeling quite strong. I've ditched the booze. I'm not getting cravings. But I keep sort of throwing my mind forward to Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, and when we always, you know, then fill in the blanks, whatever it is for you, when we always have a mince pie at 11 o'clock with a glass of something, or when we always deliver presents to a certain relative and then they always give us a glass of sherry, or, you know, it goes on and on. And these little traditions that have become so much part of who we are. And if we're not careful, that's when the wine witch creeps in. You know, that's when the addictive voice pops up and says, well, it would be rude not to. I mean, you are visiting elderly relatives, or you are, you know, with your family, and this is the tradition. And who are you to be this boring party pooper who says no to a drink? And really, you're going to have a cup of tea when we're doing this? And on it goes. And so, you know, the trick, as I've said so many times, is to prep ahead. Number one, decide what it is you want for your Christmas, for your festive season. How do you want to be? And then it may be that you have to set some boundaries around what's going to happen and the people you're going to be with, and put some self-care in place, and recognize that if you're ditching the booze right now, that is the biggest thing you will ever, ever do for your health and well-being. And by the way, it will have a fabulous knock-on effect on everyone else. But right now, the most important thing is you're doing it for you. And it is worth doing. Above all else, it's worth doing. And the really great news is that you don't actually have to feel deprived of anything at all. In fact, you know, we're the lucky ones, as the saying goes. And it really is, and here's my mantra again, keep the ritual, change the ingredients. So yes, if you know that you always have a drink at a certain time, or a certain type of drink with some kind of tradition, you know, if you watch the Queen's speech and you always have a brandy or whatever the hell these ridiculous traditions are, then make sure you've got something alcohol-free that will hit the spot, whatever that is for you. And as we've discussed so many times on this show, there is such a massive selection available now. So it's just about doing your prep. So I've got some great ideas on, I've got a blog post. If you go to thesoberclub.com, there's a blog post there called Bossing Your Sober Christmas. And there's some suggestions there about how you can get your head around all this stuff, how you can really work out what it is you want. And then there's some links to various alcohol-free drinks that are my current favourites that I, you know, recommend everyone should stock up on. And also a great recipe for making some alcohol-free mulled wine, because that's always a bit of a game changer at this time of year if you can knock that up super quickly. So those recipes are there on thesoberclub.com. Anyone can have a look at that. In our session, in our coaching session that we did for Sober Club members, we did a whole bunch of work around actually visualising what it is we want. And it really freed people up to be able to think differently about this festive season. So if you're one of these people who you're just feeling frazzled at the moment, then just take a pause, just breathe, and just honestly let it all go. Another recommendation I made on our Sober Club coaching, by the way, was that if you are feeling massively stressed about everything, a fantastic book to treat yourself to is, it's an oldie but a goodie. It's by a great friend of mine, John C. Parkin, who's another Hay House author. And it's called Fuck It, The Spiritual Way. It's just a great book for reminding you to let go of what you do not need. So I'll put the link to that in the show notes. Talking of great drinks, great alcohol-free drinks, I'm so thrilled that we've teamed up with Old Coach House Distillery, the world's first alcohol-free distillers. Now, I've spoken about this brand before. I absolutely love these drinks. These are, if you were used to be a gin drinker, you know, if you used to drink G&T, then you're just absolutely going to love this. I've mentioned before, I think, that my son, who is at uni, this one is his absolute favourite. Celtic Mist and Silk Roots are the brands, and he has that with tonic, mixes that up. We also talk about this brand in the little alcohol-free cocktail making video tutorial that I've created with my son, who's a bit of a mixologist. He really loves this. It's founded by a chemist, David O'Brien, and it's a handcrafted alcohol-free 100% copper pot distilled botanical drink. That's the technical term. He's a proper chemist, David. He's an alchemist, you might say. He's had 20 years experience working with botanicals, making extracts for all kinds of applications across food and beverages. And these products are inspired by the history of the process of distillation from its origins as a method of preparing medicines. It's funny, we forget about that, don't we? To its evolvement into distilling, you know, established spirits like gin and malts. So, as I say, there's these two products, Celtic Mist and Silk Roots. They're both pure 100% copper pot distilled botanical drinks. And here's the really important bit. They don't add any colours. There's no sweeteners. There's no sugar added. There's no flavours added. It's zero calories. I mean, it is super healthy, and it's distilled only using organic herbs and spices. So you honestly are not going to get a healthier drink. And then, you know, there's this unique process that in this particular case, with this botanical, they didn't even start the process with alcohol. So, you don't need to be concerned about even a trace of alcohol, because this is literally 0%. So Celtic Mist is a celebration of the Celtic nations and the herbs that are used in those regions. So it's this really lovely blend of juniper with citrus and rosemary notes. And obviously it goes really nicely if you want to add a really good tonic and perhaps serve it in a highball with ice. Don't forget how important it is to serve your drinks in a lovely glass, and garnish it with some lemon or a bit of fresh rosemary, perhaps. And then Silk Roots draws its inspiration from the Silk Roads, the ancient trading route from China into the West. So there's all these lovely spices associated with India. And it's this kind of aromatic, festive, warm blend of clove and cardamom. And there's this kind of hint of citrus and cinnamon. And again, serve it in a lovely glass with ice, topped with a premium tonic. And you might want to add maybe a slice of orange with that or like one of those kind of cinnamon, a quill of cinnamon bark, that goes really well with it. And what I found out about these lovely products is that they launched at the Virgin Mary Bar, which of course was Europe's first permanent dry cocktail bar. Oh, I'd love to go. I'd love to go there. It's in Dublin, of course. And you can now buy them through Amazon, through the Alcohol Free Company online. And then they're going to have their own online shop in January. And they're going to have the bottles available with a discount. So when it comes to January, I'll make sure that I give you that code. They're currently rebranding as Stillers, which is a really cool name. And as I say, they're going to have this discount code for January. Right now, you can enter our competition to win a bottle of Celtic Mist and Silk Roots. Don't forget, 100% alcohol free and no nasties whatsoever, so super healthy. So if you go to thesoberclub.com or you look at the show notes for this episode, you can get a chance to enter to win some of these great products as well. And don't forget, as I mentioned, they're featured on my little alcohol free cocktail making workshop video tutorial thingy, where you get to see a mixologist make 6 classic cocktails but with an alcohol-free twist. So if you like to actually watch something being done, that's quite an easy way of doing it. So thank you to Old Coach House Distillery, fabulous products. And, you know, talking about the importance of having these products that do not contain a whole bunch of sweeteners and just stuff you do not need. That brings me on to my guest this week, because of course, one of the issues that happens so often with people ditching the booze is that they, within a short space of time, find that they have developed a cross addiction. And in so many cases, that can be sugar. And they, you know, they suddenly find, oh my God, now I'm literally, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and the fridge is calling to me or whatever. And I've had this experience with several coaching clients that they're ditching the booze, but then they uncover these other layers of food addiction. And, you know, of course, sometimes that can be really serious eating disorders, but sometimes it's just that, well, not just, but it is just that, I've said just again, sometimes it is these habits that we have of reaching for food as comfort. And it's so ingrained in all of us, really, in many of us. And it's something we can look at. It really is something that we can work on and look at. And it wasn't my area of expertise, although I am training. I am kind of adding to my training because I think it's such an important area. But I thought it would be great to bring an expert in. So to that end, I'm just thrilled that I was able to interview Dr. Bumi Abuaba, who is a food addiction coach. Bumi has a fascinating story herself, which she'll share with you. And I've known Bumi for years, actually, and in many different capacities, because she also works with crystals. So she has this wonderful kind of a whole other thing going on, this amazing energy that she brings to everything. But her work as a, you know, in recovery and in food addiction has been, you know, she's been doing this work for years, and she's extremely skilled and extremely knowledgeable. And we were very fortunate in the Sober Club because she did an exclusive Q&A for Sober Club members, which I think was tremendously helpful for people to, you know, have their stuff addressed. But I thought, well, why not? Why not get a generic interview and bring this to you on the podcast? So I really hope you enjoy this.
Bumi, I've known you for so many years and over so many different kind of, in so many different capacities, because you do so many amazing things. You know, I don't know how much I'm going to be able to fit in here, because, you know, I really want to get to some of this stuff. But before we get into all the stuff around food addiction and the work that you're doing now, I know that you're a recovery coach and you specialize in food addiction. But before we get to that, just tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to this work.
Well, my background is, you know, I was brought up in Yorkshire, very strict kind of African background. Then Nigerian dad, very strict. It's education, education, education. And when they came to this country, they wanted us to have the best education possible. And we moved to Leeds, and we moved to from a kind of a high ethnic area. He wanted me to get a better education. And in a high ethnic area, usually the expectations of a teacher is quite low. So my parents saved hard to get into a middle class area so I can start school. I remember starting what we call, well, it's middle school. There was primary, middle and high. Mm. And I went to the middle school in a lovely little area called Shadwell in Leeds. And I remember just moving there, and I was the only black person in the school. Mm. and I think from that particular day, very, very first day, I mean, I was called names and everything else. And I mean, cut a long story short, you know, for a long time, I didn't feel good about myself because I had nobody to defend me. I was always defending myself. So I kind of, that kind of sank in, that kind of feeling less than, even though I wasn't. When I look back now, it was just, you know, it was just awful. You know, for about 2 or 3 years, you know, I've kind of had to, you know, be at that school, and I felt very different. I felt like a square peg in a round hole. You know, it was very much, I felt just very much set apart. I did have friends and stuff, but they were all kind of on the outside looking in, kind of your misfits and thing. You know, one girl went to a home, you know, we're all kind of didn't quite fit in.
Yeah.
And I think that's when it started to thinking that was different, but you know, my parents didn't want to move anywhere else. I had to stay there and tough it out. And my dad used to say, you know, you're a black woman in a, you know, a white man's world, and you're going to work 10 times as hard, and, you know, you've got to get your A's and your B's. So there was an awful lot of strictness from my dad to achieve. And one was, you know, not as bad. And I just remember, I didn't want to go to school, but I had to go to school, you know, getting into trouble a little bit, but I had to work really hard. And I just remember studying and just thinking, if there's anything that can make me feel a bit better, you know, I was very anxious, very nervous going to school, got bullied a bit until I realised I was bigger than everybody else and I could beat them up. But that didn't feel good either, and I felt like a bully. But I discovered alcohol sort of one Christmas time when I was allowed Cinzano Bianco at home. My parents weren't big drinkers or anything like that. But I just remember having this drink and just feeling amazing. Mm-hmm. And it was like, well, if this is how amazing feels like, I'm going to have more of this. So I used to sneak drink it, et cetera, et cetera. I used to water it down a little bit. And I remember my parents kind of going, you know, what, you know, it's watered down. So that was my pattern from the get-go, secretive, make me feel better. It was my medicine. It was my best friend. Mm. And I had it. Once I kind of did my exams, I would, you know, drink a little bit. I would secretly drink. I would hide the bottles. And so that was me really through sort of my teenage years. You know, I wasn't particularly sociable, you know, until about 16, 17 when my dad said, right, you can go out. It was very, very strict. You know, you don't go out until you've done well kind of thing. And, but that pattern always followed me. You know, when I was sad, I'd drink a little bit. And it wasn't a big thing. It was just, I knew at the end of the day, that was something I'm going to have and something that's going to keep me going during the day. So I was obsessing about it a lot of the time as I was getting older. University, it kind of springboarded into something else, and it became, I'm surrounded by all these, you know, I thought very, very intelligent, you know, very accomplished people, and been to kind of private school, and I've been to, you know, normal state school. And so again, it was that another kind of level of feeling less than and not good enough. And again, the only black person in dental school.
Wow.
So it was always this feeling that I was not being watched, but I stood out. Mm. And even on the outside, I looked very confident. I was always cracking jokes and, you know, that was brilliant. But inside, I wasn't feeling like that. And inside, I just felt terrified. Always had this feeling of impending doom. Anywhere I went, the minute I left my house or anywhere, I just felt scared. I always had this low level of anxiety. Mm. Didn't know where it came from, but it was always there. So that's how it went through the years. And it got worse and worse and worse. My drinking got worse. Consequences got worse. I had children, you know, I had a husband. On the outside, everything was fantastic. You know, there's my qualified dentist. You know, the kids were great. Everything was great, but I still felt shit. I didn't feel, again, I deserve. It was just the strangest feelings always. And my drinking just went absolutely out of control. You know, I took lots of time off work. I tried to hide it and I couldn't. It just got worse and worse. I landed in my first, in total, I went to 7 rehabs.
Oh, wow.
7 rehabs in a total of about probably 7 to 8 years. So once a year I was in.
Mm-hmm.
And every single time I went in, I swore I would never, you know, do it again. And I tried to find my own way. I felt very proud. You know, what is a strong black woman doing in a,
yeah,
in a rehab? You know, because culturally it's really, I mean, in general it is, but culturally from an African culture, it was like a complete shame and you wouldn't talk about it. So for me, it was, you know, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know why I can't stop, you know, and I'd have every single plan at the ready and it would fail, you know, 3 or 4 months into kind of, I would say, you know, I was a dry drunk. And then I'd drink again. And I couldn't understand it. It was baffling. Why 1 minute I'm fine and the next minute something might have happened and then bang, I'm off again. There was no rhyme or reason. And finally, the very last time I was in rehab, this is when I was about 41, 42. By this time I'd lost the use of my legs. Because I'd been drinking so much. Wow. I was on probably about a bottle of vodka a day. And they had to keep control drinking me till they find a rehab for me because it was all, everything was booked up. And literally I was, you know, the children had to be kept out of the way. Just, you know, it was just me. My sister had to come. My husband, had, you know, just couldn't be bothered with me. It was awful. It was really awful. And at the end, I was still dragging myself to that fridge to get a drink. By this time, if I'd stopped drinking, I would have fitted and probably died. But in that time, I'd had overdoses and everything else over the past, you know, few years. So in the end, I got into a rehab, thank God. And I just remember one friend of mine ringing up and said, you know, you're going to die if you do it again. You're going to die, you know. And it didn't even hit me because I was so numb. So, you know, coming out of rehab, I thought, what can I do differently? You know, that's how it started. And this time I kind of took it. I just listened to everything. I was desperate. So I listened to everyone. I went to AA. I went to groups. You know, I did what I was told because before I was quite belligerent and quite arrogant and thinking I could do it myself. But by that time I was just completely, you know, beaten. Absolutely.
So when you know all the times you're in rehab, I know we're going to move on from this, but I'm just kind of fascinated. When you were in rehab, did the kind of the root of all this never really come up? Were you ever sort of encouraged to look at the fact that you'd been feeling less than for all those years and you didn't love yourself?
Yes, we did. Yeah, but I was so entrenched in my own proudness, you know, and too proud to say and do, and I'll sort this out, and you know, what's the angle? And you know, I was very, very closed, didn't trust people. I was taught not to trust anybody. So my dad always said, don't trust anyone because they'll let you down. So I would never really express what I really wanted to, you know, whereas inside I would have loved to, but I was too scared that if I revealed the real me, you know, it'd be like, well, no wonder you drink. And so that was me. It was very much of two very different people, you know, and I had to drink to match the inside to the outside all the time. So it became this pressure to be the all singing, all dancing person, you know, and it was quite interesting when, you know, I did become, you know, this time sober, not just a dry drunk. You know, people say, I can never understand why, you know, you got yourself into such a mess because you're such a lovely person. And I said, it's nothing to do with that. It was how I felt about me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then when you finally, you know, realized how wonderful you are and started to and ditch the booze, what led you into the work that you're doing then? Because you were doing recovery. Well, I mean, you've done a load of fabulous things, but partly yeah. It was actual recovery coaching, wasn't it? Weren't you offering, I don't know if you still are, doing recovery coaching and actual intervention services?
Yeah, I do that kind of as a one-to-one, so I don't really advertise it. That's just like word of mouth. But as soon as I within probably 2 to 3 years, I also went down the holistic route of when I became sober. And I knew I had to find a different avenue. I knew there was extra things that I needed to do for me. Mm. So I found my own path in recovery, like a strength-based recovery. And it went into the holistic route. So the meditation, mindfulness. I work with crystals, as you know. Mm. So there's that crystal work. And all of that, it was almost like I found myself again.
Yeah.
And, you know, even had hobbies that I never, you know, I've never had a hobby by that time. And I've had hobbies and, you know, I was really enjoying it. So I kind of went down the holistic route. So the addiction model and the holistic model kind of really worked for me. Mm. So I thought, let me just get that out. And then people, a lot of other professionals that I knew, again, too proud, or they can think the way out of this. You can think your way out of an addiction. You can't. Mm. So I think that was my problem as well, is that, you know, I'm an intelligent woman. How's coming an intelligent woman like me who's got a degree, blah, 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 can't think herself out?
I know. It's something I say all the time. It never ceases to amaze me with all the stuff I used to do about holistic living and everything yeah. natural. And yet there I was, you know, boozing it up and just walking around this kind of elephant in the room and not yeah. being out there. You know, it's just bizarre. It is bizarre. Yeah. But Bumi, tell me then where the food addiction part comes in then. Was that something you had an experience of, or was that just something yeah. that you found with your clients?
No, I found during the time that I know today, is that my kind of addiction switched.
Right. It's so common, isn't it, that we get these cross yeah. addictions, you know, we sort yeah. thought time, sort of thing.
Exactly. And I wasn't particularly aware of it sort of during my recovery. But it did switch to food. Not so much purging, but binging. Mm. But exactly the same pattern as, you know, when I was drinking, it was secretive. You know, I'd hide a whole load of, like, I don't know, jelly rolls or something in my bag, in drawers, whatever. And I'd have to have it. It was, it's an obsessive thought, and I had to have this. It was a compulsion, like I was driven at knife point to have it. Wow. And then I slowly realized, yeah. to my horror, it's very much the feelings were the same. I felt better when I'd had something. I felt shame and guilt because I'd, you know, had a whole packet of biscuits and more. So that the whole behavior was exactly the same. And I knew that if I didn't nip this in the bud, it would end up me going back to drinking again, which was I just didn't want to do that. So again, I looked into, you know, the avenue of food addiction, compulsive eating, erratic yeah. eating. And it was very, very similar to alcohol.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you know, we talk about addiction and you know, you think about addiction to alcohol, obviously, and smoking and, you know, gambling or whatever, drugs, you know, hard drugs. They're all substances that we can stop using. You know, we can stop our addiction and no longer drink alcohol. We can stop gambling. We can stop smoking, but we can't stop eating, can we? So this is where the food addiction can sometimes feel even more complex, you know, and there's so many layers on it, isn't there? Because we all have to eat. And not only that, we all want to, you know, we want to enjoy our food, obviously. Mm-hmm. So there can be so many complex things around this. What are the kind of common, how big is the problem, do you think? How many, you know, how many people do you think eat compulsively or erratically?
I mean, they say something like between sort of 8 to 10% of the population.
I'm surprised it's not more. I'm surprised.
No, it's not more. That was the last survey. Mm. But when you actually get to talking to people, people have a certain level. There's a range. Mm. Mm. So when we're talking about full-blown condition, complete loss of control of appetite, completely binging, maybe purging, you know, it's ill stage.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of ranges in between that, erratic eating, stress eating, emotional eating. Mm. That's all there. So yeah. if we put all that together, it'll probably be about 40%.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And what about people who have stopped drinking then? How common is it that when you've stopped drinking, you would then sort of cross into food addiction? I mean, obviously the big question that will always come up is sugar, isn't it? That's practically a given, isn't it, for people when they ditch the booze? You know, it happens to us all with the best will in the world. We get a sugar head on. I mean, how common is that, and what can we do?
I find for someone who's in recovery from alcohol, it usually is sugar rather than food. And because if you've gone into recovery, let's say you've gone into a particular fellowship, you know, they normally have all the biscuits there and everything else. And it's I'd rather you have that than, you know, booze again. So that's kind of in your head. So I'd say it's more of a sugar addiction. But with alcohol, also people can turn to gambling.
Yeah.
Shopping. Internet and gaming, they're the big ones as well, because they don't want to go anywhere. All of a sudden they're just like, okay, I'm in my house, we're in lockdown anyway. So it's gaming, gambling. Food is an issue, definitely an issue, a bigger issue. The sugar is a bigger issue, I would say, from my experience.
Carry on.
But it is a problem, and especially with what's going on at the moment.
With stress.
Eating disorder charities have said they've experienced a 70% increase in the number of calls.
Really?
From new people. Yeah, wow. New clients who just can't control their eating. It's unmanageable now because of stress, fear of the future, job, things. It's off the Richter scale. So now food, I think, is probably one of the main coping mechanisms, because it's readily available. It's in the fridge, you just walk to it.
We'll talk about the whole the kind of eating disorder thing in a moment, but just back on the sugar for a moment, because I know there'll be a lot of people listening who are understandably really proud of themselves for ditching the booze, and you know, huge congrats to a lot of people listening who are have even managed to ditch the booze through lockdown and have sort of rocked it sober for 5 months, you know, which is amazing.
Well done. But
they have this kind of niggling feeling. I mean, somebody asked me to ask you a question here, you know, saying, is it possible to, in inverted commas, moderate with sugar? You know, after my sugary drinks a couple of weeks ago, I found myself having sort of reaching for handfuls of the kids' sweets and then picking up biscuits. And then that started to remind me of what I was like with alcohol. Yeah. You know, I'd give it up for a bit, then have a bit. And then before you know it, you're back to overdoing it. So I suppose the question is, you know, I mean, just like you, I always say to people I'm coaching, listen, you know, give yourself a bit of a break in the first few weeks, because you will crave the sugar. Try and make it a healthier alternative. But give yourself a little bit of a break, because obviously there's a ton of empty calories in if you've been drinking wine particularly. So give yourself a break.
Definitely.
But then as time goes on, you know, well, I suppose that's a good question. Is it possible to, in inverted commas, moderate with sugar?
Well, just look historically at the, you know, if...
look at the size of people. Yeah, I know.
Not even the size of people. It's even just the way you think of it.
Yeah.
Mental health.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you're obsessing about something that is, it's not even enough to be overweight or anything like that. It's just, you know, you feel not great.
Yeah.
So if the person feels that she's obsessing about it when she's not having it, then
that's
time to put the brakes on it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And another Sober Club member asked me as well a similar thing, saying the cravings that I feel for sugar are so similar to alcohol cravings. It's, you know,
definitely.
I want it if I'm hungry, if I'm angry, if I feel stressed, overwhelmed. So I have to kind of stay away from the food shops, just like I would the off licenses. You know, if you need to sort of pop into a shop, this member said, and buy some milk, you know, he stands in front of the sweets and then find
this
yourself picking up a load of old crap. Then of course, then what comes in is then all this hideous kind of guilt and shame and all those emotions that we thought we'd managed to knock on the head, you know, what do you do with this?
Well, I think just to, you know, kind of just make it, you know, simplify it that, you know, they've seen on PET scans of brains. I don't know if you've seen this. That sugar lights up the neural pathway stronger than cocaine.
Yes, I have seen that.
Yeah, and the mouse that, or the rats, the experiments that, you know, a rat will kill themselves to get sugar.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't with cocaine or heroin. So that's how strong, and it's called the white death, isn't it, sugar?
Yeah.
But that's how strong it lights up the limbic system, the neural pathways, the reward systems in the brain.
Yeah.
The processed sugar is like, if you think of it like this, okay, and this is what really, you know, I understood it as. Anything that becomes really refined from a natural product becomes super addictive. So if you're looking at, say, for alcohol is from the grape, you refine that, you ferment it, it's alcohol.
Yeah.
Same with a poppy, you refine that, this beautiful natural poppy, and it becomes heroin.
Yeah, and it's a really good point.
But the more processed, the more refined, the quicker it goes to the reward system.
Yeah.
The super refined sugar. So that hits the reward system, you know, very, very strongly. Mm. So yeah, sugar is, I would say, let's call it a class A drug.
Yeah, okay? Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it is. And also the lady who goes into the shop, I always suggest have a little something to eat before you go shopping.
Yeah.
So something healthy, eat that.
Yeah.
Go shopping. You're going to have that craving to pick something up.
Yeah.
So that's really, really good one.
Yeah. What's your view on sort of sugar alternatives, on, you know, healthier versions in inverted commas, whether it's stevia or so just what would
it's
you
not,
say then
it's
what?
Not black or white. I mean, I, you know, with my clients, we I always say, let's try it and see how you feel. Because there's no reason saying to somebody don't do that. But, you know, if somebody wants to try sweetness has still kind of got that super sweet. And, you know, a lot of people have said that they feel that they go back to sugar again because of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's something else. So sweetness, if it's going to help in the, you know, short term, but long term to kind of wean off it.
Mm.
But if somebody having lots of sweetener or back on the sugar because of it, then I'd say let's look at completely, you know, weaning you off the sweeteners.
So, I mean, what would you, I agree, definitely artificial sweeteners. I wouldn't go near them with a barge pole, but I mean, what would you say if people want, you know, 80% dark chocolate, you know, what would be your view about of that?
I would say 80% dark chocolate is not bad, but it's how much of it you eat.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if you're going to eat like, you know, a whole bar full and the two bar fulls, then we'll say no. But, you know, if it's, you know, It depends on the level of their range.
Whether
they're overeating and they're aware of that and want to come back, or to the fact that it's uncontrollable.
Yeah.
And if it's got to that point, then I would say we'd have to stop the dark chocolate.
Mm. So what do you, how, you know, I know this is a massive topic and you probably work with, you know, clients for months, but sort of in a nutshell then, where do people start then when they recognize, well, actually, you know, I am addicted to this. I have got a cross addiction now. Is it about going back to that mindset piece?
Yes, it is. Yeah. I think it's, you know, how do you feel when you pick that up? You know, what's it doing to you afterwards? You know, shame, the guilt, the feel, you know, the self-loathing, you know, low self-worth, you know, all of that is just devastating.
Yeah.
So it's always, you know, having pointers and guides and milestones and, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Some people are so, you know, how committed are you to, how bad is this? You know, how bad is it? How bad is it for you? What is it stopping you doing in your life? What is it, you know, if you want to wear something beautiful, I can't bear to look at myself in the mirror. I can't. You know, I want to do these things but can't because of my weight, or I don't feel great because I've, you know, there's so many different parameters, there's so many different variations, and it's always boils down to, you know, how much do you want to, you know, get well, you know, from where you are now. You know, it's a state of change, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And that's where this all gets so interesting, doesn't it? Because when you're locked in the cycle, you don't love yourself very much at all.
You don't.
At all. You don't really have a lot of self-esteem. So you can't be asked. And that's, you know, and I remember, you know, I couldn't meditate or sit with myself at all because I didn't feel authentic, you know? And so I totally see how people get into this cycle, and particularly with the stress of lockdown, there are people who are just, you know, they were maybe starting to do okay. And then it's like yet more stress hits them. And they just think, just hit the fuck it button. Like how do I get out of this? So it's very difficult. Yeah. It's very difficult.
It is very difficult. And that's why I would say with addiction or any kind of compulsion, you can't think yourself, you cannot think your way out of it. That's why things have to, certain, you know, rituals or, you know, methods have to be systemized, have to be automatic. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was for me. You know, things had to be a little bit more automatic in my day, more structured day. You know, the more structured my day, the better it became. Mm-hmm. But you can't do this alone as well. You need a buddy system, like you said, what you've set up now, that you've got, you know, people need support. You cannot do this on your own.
No, absolutely.
That is the crux of anybody who wants to get well. You join something like
that. Yeah, you need connection. Definitely.
That's primary.
Yeah. Let me ask you about eating disorders, you know, for want of a better word. Someone asks here, you know, obviously I told Sober Club members I was doing this interview, and someone says here, you know, what first steps can I take to break an entrenched cycle of binge eating and bulimia over a number of decades? So, you know, this person has potentially stopped drinking, but there still could be this cycle of an eating disorder going on, and it might have been going on for decades, literally.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, as you know, there are kind of eating disorder groups that, you know, we can join. Mm. And again, it's about fellowship. It's about connection and getting there. But also, there's different ways of doing things, but seeing, an eating disorder coach or a food addiction coach so that we can get a strategy together. There's lots of powerful techniques. But if she's tried again and again and again and got the same result, you know, she needs to get out of her own way and be able to say, right, I need help, you know, and have somebody specialised there to kind of be her, you know, her quiet cheerleader and mentor and guide her. This is when it gets serious and, you need specialised help.
Absolutely. How often do you see eating disorders, you know, anorexia, bulimia, those kind of things that we...
This is where I have my kind of boundaries, because that's a completely different ballgame altogether.
Okay.
And this is where I would definitely refer on to either rehab or a specialist psychiatrist or a psychotherapist that deals with eating disorders, whereas mine's disordered eating, which could become an eating disorder. It's a very sort of grey area. But if I recognise that there's anorexia going on, the more extreme, then I will refer on. It's not something that I will tackle.
Okay. So what would be your top tips then, Bumi? I realize it's such a complex topic. It feels like we're sort of fluffing over the top, really, which, you know, I know people can find out more about your work, but what would be sort of the top lines, do you think, then, for people who sort of recognize these that they sometimes veer towards, just as you say, disordered eating to a greater or lesser extent? What is there anything that we can do if we're not full blown into it yet? What can we do just to kind of rein it in and really take a grip, as it were?
Get a grip.
Yeah, get a grip, girl.
I would say, first of all, sort of maybe spend kind of a week or two just journaling. Of what you're eating, how you're feeling. Because it's all to do with emotions as well. I mean, there's food addiction, which could be a biochemical thing. And, you know, it's the cart before the horse, you know, it's the mind-body connection, vice versa. But, you know, I always say, do some journaling before you come and see me. Do some journaling, see how you're feeling around when you pick up, you know, when you eat it, why, and do all of this and just get this picture on, you know, for yourself of, you know, where you feel. And then the simplest thing for me is support. Also, systematize your eating. which again just needs a little bit of guidance. But you know, we're talking about meal plans, so you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner. Breakfast, lunch and dinner, because we a lot of us don't do that.
No, absolutely.
Systemizing it, because then it becomes automatic, and maybe the odd snack, sugar-free, you know, snack, you know, an apple or whatever. But just try and see if you can do that. And if you can do that in 2 weeks, and if you feel that's great, then let's see if you can continue. If you're finding you're falling off the, you know, off that that track, then you need help. But yeah, just systemizing. I'm a big believer in sort of holistic therapies. So the meditation, even just going for a walk. If someone feels, you know, pick up the phone.
I think you know, you're so right. It so much of it is about the noticing, the being conscious, isn't it?
Being
so,
aware. You know, and that's where transformation
just picking up the
comes.
Yeah, exactly. And instead of just, you know,
there's no thought. Yeah, so there needs to be that second thought between
That gap. I call it the gap between the thoughts. Yeah,
the gap, and that gap would be, do I really need this? Or that gap could be, I just better pick up the phone, and also have a list of friends who understand, so that as soon as you're feeling like that, you could pick up the phone to somebody, and you could even make it such that, you know, say, you know, Jenny, Janet, can you be my buddies in the morning?
Exactly. Yeah. You know,
Nikki, Anna, can you be my, you know, my buddies in the evening or something like that? If it's an emergency, can I just, and then have that, you know, and then check in with people.
And you're so right about the journaling.
Just because, do that daily.
You know, again, if we, you know, when we sort of get those thoughts out, it really helps. I always encourage everyone to do that when they first stop drinking.
I just do a brain dump, you know. Just a brain dump.
Yeah,
brain
exactly. Dump. But to write down what you're eating, I mean, actually, most of us don't kind of do that. But it's not a case of list it all out so that you can look at it and go, oh my God, how very dare you,
it's not about shaming. No, exactly.
Because you're so right.
We've had enough of that.
But it's the emotional picture, isn't it? And most of us haven't learned to sit with our feelings at all, you know, so we don't even recognize the feeling, you know, when a feeling comes in. I mean, it's like you were saying earlier, you know, in the olden days, you know, you didn't sit with any of those feelings. You just kind of reached for the drink, and as we all did.
Yeah, we weren't trained to sit with our feelings. And just say, what is that? And then, you know, just bringing it out. And it's part of our story, which, you know, just needs to be unpicked and unraveled. And it's about changing that story, you know, changing that dialogue that's going on in your head, and having somebody to help you do that. As I said, because sometimes I'm not, you know, I wasn't the best of my own thinking. You know, I had somebody to help pick it out for me. So it's kind of a transformative journey. But it's about fulfillment, and it's about a sense of self-fulfillment. And this is what, you know, it was for me, you know, and I just came to believe that I just didn't feel fulfilled at a deeper level, kind of a soul level. And that's what I had to start. That food was filling that up. I had to start filling that with other great things. And it wasn't food or alcohol.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're
finding that fulfillment.
Just briefly, I mean, on the same kind of question, I suppose, in a way, but, you know, when we think of comfort eating, you know, we think of, and I mean, this has been ingrained in us since children, most of us, hasn't it? You know, we fall over, we hurt our knee, and we get given a biscuit.
First thing is comfort,
to stop us crying,
treats.
You know. So we've all got this ridiculous association that if we're upset, someone hands us sugar. And you know, I'm ashamed to say
you get fed. I mean, as a baby, we get fed. The minute you cry, you get fed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's even from there. It's, you know, from, you know, the comfort is immediately, you know, you get fed as a baby because you're hungry, because you're crying. So it is an inbuilt thing. But it, you know, it can kind of go to the extremes as well.
Oh, it's fascinating. It really is fascinating.
I love it.
It's an amazing topic. So I know that you do a whole bunch of work with people. You're the creator of the first certified food addiction certification to support nutritionists and personal trainers and dietitians. Which is fantastic, by the way, because, you know, one of the things that frustrates me most, I mean, we won't get off on a whole new thing, but
but it does frustrate me that, you know, if you do kind of rock up to dietitians or whatever, or if God forbid you're in hospital, I mean, the kind of food, you know, you're given there is, I mean, just shocking, doesn't even cover it, you know.
I think it's, that's the reason why I decided to do it, because I mean, recovery coaching was very niche. It was a bit too niche. And I thought something like food addiction or compulsive eating, I'm sure a lot of health professionals wouldn't recognize the signs.
Exactly.
Not even just the basic signs. And I thought that's where it needs to go to, not just the niche of people who decide to take on, you know, recovery coaching. It needs to kind of go out there. Mm. And I've actually sent my strategies to Matt Hancock and Parliament. I've sent it to Parliament. You know, I've got a few replies, but, you know, oh, we're busy at the moment. But I want to still keep going, because I just think we need strategies. People need to be more aware.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's raising awareness, raising self-awareness, and that's where transformation comes. There's no point just giving advice. You know, we need more, you know, awareness.
Yeah, absolutely. So just give us your website then, Bumi, where people can find out more about your work.
Right, okay. So it's www.thefoodaddictioncoach.co.uk.
Thank you so much, Bumi. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you, Bumi. So the links are in the show notes, and I definitely think we should do a piece on crystals at some point with Bumi as well, changing the subject completely. In the Sober Club, we have got our Christmas bash coming up, sadly online, obviously. But if you wanted to join us before then, we are open. You're very welcome to check it out, thesoberclub.com. Our Christmas bash, by the way, we've got Jo Soley, a fabulous numbers girl. You may have heard our podcast a few months ago where Jo talks about the power of numbers, and we're going to be looking at personal years. So I thought that would be a fabulous party gift to Sober Club members, and looking at how our personal year affects what's going on. So we do all kinds of stuff, and as you know, there's just so much in the member portal and as part of our community. So check that out if it interests you, thesoberclub.com. Just a reminder to check out our competition, enter our competition to win some Celtic Mist and some Silk Roots from Old Coach House Distillery. You've got to be in it to win it, as they say. And make sure that you follow me on social media. It's at Jane Lee Grace. As you know, my book is going to be out. It's not out till February. You can pre-order if you're excited about the idea already. Hope so. It's called Happy, Healthy, Sober, Ditch the Booze and Take Control of Your Life. And obviously, I'll tell you a bit more about it nearer the time. Meanwhile, do check out that blog post. I'll put the link to it in the show notes. And if you are one of these people who is getting frantic about Christmas, please take a pause, just breathe, look after yourself, put that self-care in place. And if you're struggling right now, reach out for help. Honestly, please reach out for help. There is so much help available. I know it feels at the moment like nothing's being catered for. I know it's really, really difficult with mental health issues and knowing where to go for help. But there is always people that you can reach out to. Do check out Alcohol Change UK as a great charity. There are so many services, but you've got to ask, you've got to reach out. And I know that feels really hard when you're not in a great place. So always, please reach out for help. Please take care of yourself. It's that weird time of the year when some people can just go really insular and kind of hole up and not want to share how they're feeling with anyone. So I'd say try and do the opposite. Become, you know, feeling okay at Christmas curious, and just see how that works for you. See if you can put a different spin on it this time. I will see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.